Well, good afternoon, everyone. Let's start today in 2 Peter 3. We're going to look at 2 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4. This is toward the end of the time that Peter was kicking about this earth. He's coming towards the end of his mission, his commission that God had given to him. And he's speaking to the church at this time, and warning them about some things that some were coming to feel. We have 2 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4. Knowing this first, talking about the end times, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Well, indeed, things had not worked out quite as the apostles and many others in the church probably thought they were going to work out. Here Peter was coming towards the end of his life, and it seemed like things certainly were going on much longer. Back in Acts 1 and verse 6, we know that the disciples of Jesus Christ certainly felt like the kingdom was coming in their day, because they had asked Jesus there after his resurrection, Lord, will you at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? So this was kind of an expectation. And yet we see in 2 Peter, as I noted, here he was at the end of his life, knowing that he wasn't going to be around and the church was going to continue on after him. Let's go back to 2 Peter. Let's look at verses chapter 1, verses 12 through 15. So why is it that Peter wrote this letter to the church? He wrote it because he said, I will not be negligent to put you always in remembrance of these things, though you know them, and be established in the present truth. Yea, I think it appropriate, as long as I am in this tabernacle, this body of mine, to stir you up to putting you in remembrance, knowing that shortly I must put off this my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus Christ has shown me. Moreover, I will endeavor that you might be able, after my decease, to have these things always in remembrance. Well, now, Peter, of course, wasn't the only one that had different ideas about the church and the coming of Jesus Christ. We know this was also the case for those whom Paul spoke to, and indeed of Paul himself. Let's go to Thessalonians. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians. I think I'm looking at chapter 4. Didn't come out on the printout here. Yes, okay, chapter 4 and verses 16 and 17. So here, Paul notes, he's talking to the Corinthians, some whose faith had been kind of disturbed by some teachers who had come out and spoken, not with his authority, but sometimes in his name, or, you know, using his name, the name of other disciples or apostles, even though they didn't have such authority. But here, he says here, and the Lord himself, so this is Paul writing to the Thessalonians this first time, shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. And then notice here, he says, then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. So Paul places himself here as one of those who is going to be alive at Christ's return. And this is fairly early in his ministry, but we go back over to 2 Timothy, we'll see that he too came to a realization towards the end of his life, 2 Timothy 4, that indeed things were going to go on for a while longer. 2 Timothy 4, verses 6 through 11 here. He's writing to Timothy, one of his disciples in the Lord. He says, I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not to me only, but to unto all of them that love his appearing. Then he goes on to give Timothy some advice here. But notice how he's feeling at this point in time. He's in prison. It's late in his life. He says, do your diligence to come shortly to me. For Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and is departed unto Thessalonica, Crescens to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. So he's feeling a little bit despondent because so many people have left to go do other things. And he even notes that some apparently may have even left off the faith. Then we get to verses 17 and 18. Verses 17 and 18. Notwithstanding, the Lord stood with me. So how did Paul keep on, even though he was feeling a little bit depressed here towards the end of his life, as he was, you know, the only one here at the prison where he was? Notwithstanding, the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, that by me the preaching might be fully known, and that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion, and the Lord shall deliver me from every evil work, and will preserve me into his heavenly kingdom, to whom be glory forever and ever. And so Paul never gave up. He knew that God was with him and would be with him. But that was not the case with, unfortunately, many in the church of God. If we were to read into the writings of Eusebius, who's writing much later, about the 3rd century or so, he talks about a sect called the Ebionites. Now, the Ebionites, they do get mixed up a lot with the Nazarenes and with others in the church who held on to various holy days and Jewish traditions. But the Ebionites, at least in the account that Eusebius has, had come to believe, after, of course, the destruction of Jerusalem, that Jesus was not a divine individual. He had been a great teacher. They should follow his teachings. But he wasn't divine. He wasn't the Son of God. They kind of left off that feeling, that belief, because of the events that had happened around them, with the destruction of the temple and so on and so forth, and Jesus not returning. And then we have, throughout the history of mankind, various peoples placing the return of Jesus Christ in their own day, and then being summarily disappointed. We could talk about the man Melitz of Kromeritz. 1365 to 1367 is the date that he set for Jesus Christ's return. Then we have in 1694, there was a German teacher named Alsted who said that Jesus Christ would be returning in 1694. The Huguenots, we know most of them came and they settled much of our country, but they had Jesus Christ returning in 1689. Didn't happen. German J.A. Bengel settled on a date of 1836. And William Miller, who some of the Church of God actually kind of came out of that, some of that movement, he had set a date of 1843 to 1844. And even our own church, some had settled on a date of 1975 at one point. So it's possible sometimes to get discouraged, feeling that the kingdom is so far away. It's possible to get drawn into this line of thinking that Peter discusses there in 2 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4, where we think that, you know, everything's gone on since the beginning of creation like so, and it's just going to keep going on that way. There are so many trials, and so what are we doing all this for? So how do we avoid that line of thinking, and how do we remain hot for the truth of God? As I note, all of these different dates here show that the line of thinking that Jesus Christ is returning in our own day is not an uncommon one. And it's been one that's gone all the way back to the first century of the church. And here we are 2,000 years later. But really, that line of thinking, we can say, even goes back into the Old Testament. Now, how do I mean that? How can I say that people were expecting the return of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament before Jesus Christ even came. I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about faith, faith to believe that God will do what he says he will do in his prophecies. Today we're going to look at one man who was the recipient of a prophecy about his own self, but who had to go through many trials before he was able to come into the fulfillment of that prophecy that God himself had given. And that man that we're going to talk about today is David, arguably the greatest king of ancient Israel, but also arguably the most prepared, outside of Jesus himself, for that kingship. A preparation much tougher than most of what we have had to endure. And we also, of course, are being prepared to be king. So what steps did David of old take to remain faithful to God through all the trials that he experienced? Today we'll look at four traits that David finessed in preparing for that kingship. All right, four traits David finessed in preparing for that kingship. Traits, we might say, that God finessed within David. So our first trait, the first trait for that, let's go to 1 Samuel 17, 1 Samuel 17, verses 34 through 37. That first trait is faith. The first trait is faith. Now, here we'll see something before David was even knew that he would be a king or even was king. Here he is, just a lowly shepherd boy. But these experiences that he had as a shepherd in 1 Samuel 17, verses 34 through 37, created in him a level of faith that allowed him to move forward through the times that were the tough times that were going, the times that were going to be even tougher that were yet to come. 1 Samuel 17, verses 34 through 37. Here, David, this is at the point where David is going to go out and fight Goliath. And of course, Saul is kind of the view that maybe you want to wear some armor, and others are thinking, why would you do that? He's a very strong man, and so on and so forth. But David says unto Saul here in verse 34 of chapter 17, "Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Your servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." David said, "Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord shall be with you." So David built a level of faith in his small task, his small job as a shepherd, through the incredible workings that God had already done for him. And so that allowed him to move forward into the experiences that he was about to have. So our second point, so that was first point was faith. Second point here, David had hope and vision. David had hope and vision. If we were to go to Hebrews 6 and verse 1, we would see that faith and hope, of course, go together. Because faith is the substance of things hoped for. Okay, so our definition of faith essentially involves hope. You have to have something to have hope in order to be able to have faith. What kind of vision, what kind of hope did David have? Well, this gets down to the prophecy that we're going to read about here. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 1. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 1. All right, so God had not been pleased with Saul as a king of Israel, and so he set Samuel out here, 1 Samuel 16 and verse 1, and said unto Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing as I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil, and go, and will send you unto Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king from among his sons." kings. All right, and then we drop down to verse 13. Who was this king? And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him, that is David, in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. So David is anointed to be king of Israel. All right. Well, obviously, David knew what was going on. Samuel had placed him into this position via God's authority. And so, if you were in that position, knowing that you were going to be a king, indeed, we had been told we're going to be kings, how would you feel? Well, God's going to start setting things up in my life to make things work towards me being that king that I've been anointed to become. And indeed, that's the way things seemed to go. Let's go to verses 15 through 23 of this chapter. We're going to see how David now gets mixed up with this royal family. Things seem to be going very, very well, as we'll see. And Saul's servant said unto him, "Behold, now an evil spirit from God troubles you. Let our Lord now command your servants, which are before you, to seek out a man who is a cunning player on a harp. And it shall come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon you, that he shall play with his hand, and you shall be well." And Saul said unto his servants, "Provide me now a man that can play well, and bring him to me." Then answered one of the servants, and said, "Behold, I have seen the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, that is a cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him." And so Saul sent messengers unto Jesse, and said, "Send unto me who? David. David, your son, which is with the sheep." So David's called into the royal household. How's God going to fulfill this prophecy, essentially, this anointing that he's given David? Well, he's going to bring him into the royal household. If I'm David, I'm thinking, this is really remarkable. Here I am in contact with the king. I'm going to have a kingly upbringing via this ability of mine to play the harp. Continuing on here, "And Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a bottle of wine and a kid and sent them to by David his son and unto Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, 'Let David, I pray you, stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight.'" Wow. Things are really looking up. I am on my way to being a king. This prophecy of God is coming true. But things, of course, didn't work out that way. As we'll see, of course, and as we know, Saul grew jealous and paranoid. But before that, well, he gave to his to David his daughter, Michal, to be a greater target of Israel's enemies and probably also to spy on him. And we would learn that in 1 Samuel 18, verse 21. But to David, of course, being given the daughter Michal by Saul, what would that have meant? That would have made me think, well, I'm being, again, brought into the royal family. And God is fulfilling what he has said he is going to do with me. He must have thought great things. But then things start to make a very big change. Let's go to 1 Samuel 19. 1 Samuel 19. We'll look at verses 1 through 10. So as time goes on, here's David has a wife who's the king's wife. He's the harp player, the armor bearer for the king, and so on and so forth. And then things start to change. "And Saul spoke unto Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David." Saul, of course, has grown jealous of David because of the things that David has done and that God has done through David. "And Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, 'Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Now, therefore, I pray you, take heed to yourself until the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. and I will commune with my Father of you, and what I see, that will I tell you. So, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here to get back together, and things aren't as bad as they seem. And yet, of course, what Jonathan does here is he speaks good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, because his works have been to you very good. And he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine. The Lord brought with a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and did rejoice. Wherefore then will you sin against his innocent blood to slay David without a cause? And David hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan, and Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be slain. So Jonathan called David in, and Jonathan showed him all these things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. And then there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and they fled from him. And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand, and David played in his hand. So here they have this realignment again. Things seem to be looking up, and then suddenly it all goes south. And Saul sought to smite David, even to the wall with the javelin, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin into the wall, and David fled and escaped to him at that night. Well, what do you think David's thoughts were at this point? Let's go to verse 1 of chapter 20. And David said, fled from Naoloth in Ramah, and came and said before Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity, my sin? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? David has no idea what's going on here, doesn't understand why Saul is after him. And honestly here, I'm guessing David is beginning to wonder about this anointing, this prophecy that was to come to pass with him becoming the king. And things aren't going to get any better. Let's go to 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 through 7. So here, David here now is fleeing for his life. And he comes to Nob, to Abimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said to him, why are you alone and no man with you? And David said unto Ahimelech the priest, the king has commanded me a business, and has said unto me, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send you, and what I have commanded you, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Now therefore, what is under your hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or what is there, or what there is present. So David's hungry. He's off on his own. He's begging for food. And the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread under my hand, but there is hallowed bread, if the young man have kept themselves at least from women. And David answered the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is a manner of common, yea, though it was sacrificed this day in the priest. So the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there, but the show bread that was taken from before the Lord to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. Now this is very important. We're going to come back to Doeg later. We'll see here though that David is on the run. He's asking for food. He continues on that run. Let's go to chapter 22, 1 Samuel 22, verses 1 through 5. David departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. Now we're going to see here that David is fleeing for his life, and now his family is going to become involved with him, and his family itself is going to come to a place where it too is not safe. So he's not only been affected by himself, but affecting his very family. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him and became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, and I pray you, come forth and be with you, till I know what God will do for me. You know, I'm at this point I'm kind of confused, and I gotta protect my family. I gotta, you know, can you take care of them until I know what God's working out? You know, it's kind of amazing that David still was looking to God here after all that had happened to him. And the prophet Gad said unto David, "Abide not in the hold, depart and get you into the land of Judah." And David departed and came into the forest of Herath. All right. So, he keeps this vision and he keeps this faith. That brings us to the third thing that David did in preparing to be a king, and that is that he kept a prayerful mindset. He kept a prayerful mindset. You know, we've been reading a lot in 1 Samuel. Now we're going to go over into the Psalms, because the Psalms actually express what David was thinking and feeling at this time. We have various Psalms that talk about what happened, and it can enlighten us about David's very own thoughts from the events that were happening in Samuel. So in Psalm 142, we'll see that this is a prayer from the time when David was in this cave that we just read about. And he says here, "I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and with my voice unto the Lord did I make supplication." So David continued to call upon God. "And I poured out my complaint before him, and I showed before him my trouble. And when my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then you knew my path. In the way wherein I walked, have they privily laid a snare for me." You know, everybody's looking to get me. Saul's looking to get me. "And I looked on my right hand, and behold, there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. So I cried unto whom? I cried unto you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. Attend unto my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise your name. The righteous shall compass me about, for you shall deal bountifully with me." Okay, we can go back to Psalm 57. We have yet another prayer from this time of David's dealings in the cave. And we'll see here in Psalm 57 that David did not give up hope or faith. Then he continued in prayer with God. Psalm 57, "Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusts in you. Yea, in the shadow of your wings will I make my refuge until all these calamities be overpassed. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performs all things for me." And so we could continue on there, but the basic point is he continued to look to God. He continued to have faith in God, and he did so by continuing to call on him and to pray to him, and knowing that God was merciful and God would fulfill his word. Now, did things improve for David at that point when he prayed? Well, we'll see that not quite so. Go back to 1 Samuel 22. Let's look at verses 11 through 16. Remember this Doeg guy that we talked about earlier. "Then the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub." So this is the man that fed David. "And all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, Hear now, you son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here I am, Lord. And Saul said unto him, Why have you conspired against me? You and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait, as at this day. And then Ahimelech answered the king and said, Who is this faithful among all your servants is David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goes out at your bidding, and is honorable in your house. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me, let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, and your servant knew nothing of all this other stuff, less or more or less. And the king said, You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. Why was that? How did he know all this? Well, he knew all this because Doeg had been there, and he went and squealed on Ahimelech. So now David's troubles are affecting not only himself, they're affecting his family, they're affecting all who try to do something for him. Verses 20 through 23, we see... Yeah, basically the point here, that David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of the persons of your father's house. This is the son of Ahimelech that had escaped from being killed. So David's feelings at this point obviously wouldn't have been very strong or very good, you've got to think. So the fourth thing that he did, so we have faith, we have hope, we have prayerful mindset. Fourth thing is that he continued to wait on God. He waited on God. He had patience. Let's go to Psalm 52. Psalm 52. Here we have David's thoughts about this period when Doeg has betrayed his helper. Psalm 52, David writes, why boast you yourself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endures continually. Your tongue devises mischiefs like a sharp razor, working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. You love all devouring words, O you deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and root you out of the land of the living. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is a man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise you forever because you have done it, and I will wait on your name, for it is good before your saints. I will wait on your name. So David continued to wait on God. He prayed, he had that vision as well. And even though all of the bad things that had happened to him on his way towards kingship seemed to be pointing in a completely other direction. Let's go to 1 Samuel 23. 1 Samuel 23. We'll look at verses 14 and 15. So David continues on the run. Like I said, he's had his family, he's had friends, others who've been killed because of his loyalty to God. Verse 14 here in 1 Samuel 23. And David abode in the wilderness in the stronghold and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. So here he is out in the wilderness. And Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. God continued to deliver him. And David saw that Saul was come to seek out his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. And then we drop down to, let's drop down to verse 19. And then came up the Ziphites to Saul to Gibeah, saying, does not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood and in the hill of Hakilah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now therefore, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to come down, and our part shall be to deliver him, that is David, into the king's hand. And Saul said, blessed be you of the Lord, for you have compassion on me. Go, I pray you, prepare yet, and know and see his place where his haunt is, and who has seen him there, for it is told me that he deals very subtly. See therefore, and take knowledge of all the lurking places where he hides himself, and come you again to me with the certainty, and I will go with you. And it shall come to pass, if he be in the land, I will search him out throughout all the thousands of Judah. So Saul is really close now. He's almost got David in his hands. How does Saul feel about this? I mean, how does David feel about this? Go to Psalm 54. Psalm 54. Here we have David's thoughts in the wilderness of Ziph as he's running away from Saul. Save me, O God. He calls out to God here. By your name, and judge me by your strength. Hear my prayer, O God, if give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They have not set God before them. Behold, God is my helper. The Lord is with them that upholds my soul. He shall reward evil unto my enemies, and cut them off in your truth. I will freely sacrifice unto you. I will praise your name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me out of all trouble, and my eye has seen his desire upon my enemies. So David continued to have that faith. It seems almost surreal, in a sense, that David can continue to believe so strongly. But we're going to see here that David is going to begin at some point to really feel a little bit less strongly. Let's go to verse 24 through 28. 24 through 28 of chapter 23 of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 23, verses 24 through 28. And they rose and went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the plain of the south of Jeshimon. And Saul also and his men went to seek him, and they told David wherefore he came down into a rock and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David into the wilderness of Maon. So it's not just, he's left Ziph, now he's in this other place. Saul just keeps coming after him. And Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. And David made haste to get away for fear of Saul, for Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them. But now here, notice here what happens. There came a messenger unto Saul, saying, haste you and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land. Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing David after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore they called the place Selah Hamelekoth. So God rescues David in this case, this situation, and he's left now in a place of safety somewhat. But remember, he sent his family to be saved and so on and so forth. And remember that he'd been given Michael as his wife, and that was his connection to the royal family. And we go to chapter 25, 1 Samuel 25 and verse 44, and we note now that Saul, who's been pursuing his life, takes away this wife of David's. And Saul had given Michael, his daughter, David's wife, to Phalti, the son of Laish, which was Galim. So now he loses that connection to the royal family. He loses his wife. Things don't look so great. Let's go to 1 Samuel 27. 1 Samuel 27, verse 1. 1 Samuel 27 and verse 1. We'll notice here, after all of these trials, David, as I noted, is finally coming to a place where he's feeling a little bit hopeless. And David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in the coast of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand. And it was told Saul that David was fled into Gath, and he sought him no more again for him. So David is at a point now where he is just tired, and he flees into the Philistines. So what we do know there is that God did give him a way of escape, and that escape was to go unto the Philistines. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. Here we see something that God also promises us, that when we are in trials and temptations, and that even as he did with David, he gave David this way out. Here he has here, he says, there shall has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. And so David had been given a way to bear the testing and the trial that he was given, and he was given that way of escape. So what does David's life here teach us about our lives today? Well, David, as I noted, was to be a king. And he went through a lot of training to be that king. A lot of fleeing for his life. A lot of depending on God in times of a great distress. More distress than we've ever experienced, I'm guessing most of us. And so too, though, when we are under stress, we should continue to have that faith, that prayerful attitude, that vision always before us, and that patience and waiting on God. Let's go to James 1. James 1, verses 2 through 4. Here, we're given some instructions by one of Jesus' brothers. He tells us, gives us some instruction here. He says here, in James 1, verses 2 through 4, knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience. Okay, and that's what David had to go through. But let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So that patience, that building of patience, works us towards in perfection, so that we come to a place where we are perfected in the way that God would have us be. Well, let's go back to 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3. So Peter had been talking about, writing about, how some scoffed. Some said, you know, we've been waiting for this end of the world from the beginning of time. Where is this happening? He gives us some different instructions here. He tells us a little bit about how a God sees what he's doing and sees time. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering to usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And so God, essentially, is giving us more time, it says here. More time to build that faith and that patience and that perfectedness. And so we shouldn't dither and dally and scoff and become impatient because God hasn't worked in our time. He's working on a different time scale. And so God promises us deliverance. He promises us, as his followers, deliverance both physically and spiritually. Let's go to Revelation 3 and verse 10. Revelation 3 and verse 10. We see here an example of the deliverance that he promises to his church, a physical deliverance. Because you have kept the word of my patience, I will also keep you from the hour of temptation which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. So here, God promises a physical deliverance for those who keep that word of patience, who keep the faith despite all that goes on. Let's go back to Luke 21. Luke 21, verses 16 through 19. Here we'll see God promises something even greater than that. He promises spiritual deliverance for those who keep the faith and keep his word. Luke 21, verses 16 through 19. And you shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren. Well, what was David? David was betrayed by Doeg, by Saul, many people that he knew, and kinsfolks and friends. And some of you shall they cause to be put to death, and shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, and there shall not perish, but there shall not perish a hair of your head. In your patience possess you your souls. And so we can say here, it's interesting that he says he's going to cause some to be put to death, and yet not, and their hair will not perish. So obviously he's not talking about physical deliverance here. He's talking about a greater deliverance, a deliverance much greater than that, one of spiritual deliverance, and that God will do so if we just are patient. Let's go to Hebrews 11. We'll close there. Hebrews 11, verses 39 and 40. Why has God taken so long in earthly years? We see here that God has this great plan. Because if he hadn't taken so long, if he'd ended things back in Peter's day, you know, you and I wouldn't have an opportunity to be part of this family of God that he's creating. And if times go on long beyond us, or just beyond us, likewise, he has plans for other family members that he wants. And that's what he says here in Hebrews 11, verses 39 through 40. And these people that have had faith, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. They didn't get it in their day. God, having provided some better thing for us, for the persons writing this book at this time, and now for those of us reading it, that they, without us, should not be made perfect. So God has given us an opportunity to be first fruits with men like David, men of great faith, and men like Peter, and men like Paul. And we just need to remember that and hang on to that and practice the same techniques that David used to stay faithful to God throughout our lives, even as this world continues on in the course of the various horrible things that are happening, and even in the trials that we might have to experience among them.